21. Speak now, or forever be in pieces. In learning how to express ourselves, it's useful to be aware of our usual modus operandi, or method of operating. People respond to conflict in one of five ways: 1, by accepting it; 2, by retreating from it; 3, by surrendering to it or suppressing it; 4, by fighting; or 5, by shutting down. Acceptance is the healthiest response. This person sees and accepts the situation for what it is, and doesn't become angry or allow his emotions to dictate his response. Rationally and objectively, he weighs the options, and then fortifies his decision with the necessary emotional weight. Retreat is typical of passive-aggressive individuals who withdraw to avoid confrontation. The passive-aggressive person lacks the confidence and courage to face the situation head-on, so he backs down in the moment but gets back at the person in another way at another time. His retaliation or revenge may take the form of being late, forgetting to do something important for the other person, or just generally inconveniencing the other person in some way. The person who surrenders his anger simply gives up and gives in, a response that often reflects codependency and a doormat or compliant personality type. He doesn't feel worthy enough to stand up for himself, and or feels incapable of advancing his own agenda, needs, and wishes. If he is not conscious of these thoughts, then he suppresses his anger and is unaware that it is eating him up inside. In fact, he may declare, to both himself and to others, to be a very calm and easygoing person who just rolls with things and doesn't get too ruffled, while the anger manifests into myriad physiological and emotional issues. The distinction between this class and the passive-aggressive is that the latter doesn't feel entitled to assert himself, while the former does, but feels unable to do so directly. The fourth potential response, fighting, produces direct, unhealthy conflict. This person, emotionally charged and enraged, chooses to battle it out head-on without the benefit of composure and reason. Finally, if one's emotional state is fragile and the circumstance too overwhelming, he may shut down in an attempt to shut out the pain. Express yourself. Whether we are the type to convey our anger passively or openly, or to swallow it or wallow in it, we must learn to express ourselves in a way that optimizes how the other person will hear what we say. As we discussed, we want to approach the person with humility and respect and calmly communicate how we feel without necessarily assigning blame or assuming a malicious intent. Most importantly, we have to say something. The single biggest killer in any relationship is resentment. Resentment is frozen anger from the past that continues to rear its head. When something distresses us, and we can't deal with it on our own in a healthy way, then it's time to do something, because if we don't speak up when necessary, we may act out in inappropriate ways. Need a little help asserting yourself? Here's a simple technique from cutting-edge research. And in an upcoming chapter, we'll learn an additional strategy to radically transform our self-concept to become more confident, which makes it considerably easier to assert ourselves. Research out of Harvard University has found a direct correlation between body language and the release of hormones. For both men and women, higher levels of testosterone increase feelings of confidence, while lower levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, reduce anxiety and improve your ability to deal with stress. In just 2 minutes of maintaining a high-power pose, which is open and relaxed, hormone levels shift dramatically, with a 20% increase in testosterone and a 25% decrease in cortisol. The Wonder Woman stance is a good example of the power pose. Stand with feet apart, hands on hips, shoulders back. Holding this stance for just 2 minutes offers immediate results because you will be physiologically primed and inclined to assert yourself with greater ease, and practicing this pose several times a day can increase our confidence levels in the long term. Because the research is new, Conflicting findings question the extent of hormonal fluctuations. But what remains certain are the multitude of studies with unanimous agreement that such postures and poses have a direct impact on mood and produce a wide range of near-instantaneous cognitive and behavioral changes. For example, in one such experiment, subjects were randomly assigned to adopt one of two postures, either slumped in their seat or sitting straight up, while filling out a mock job application. Asked for an honest self-evaluation, those in the latter group rated themselves more competent and capable than their slouching counterparts. Unfreezing resentment. There's a right and a wrong way to express ourselves, and our approach can make all the difference in the world. As we know for ourselves, sometimes we're more open, and other times the slightest critical comment can send us crawling under the nearest rock or make us defensive and argumentative. What we say, how we say it, where we say it, and when we say it will influence how other people receive our comments. The following 10 steps will help ensure that we express our words in the optimum ego-free manner so that people hear them in the kindest way. If, despite our best efforts, we know the person will become defensive and angry with us, a great technique is to preface our words with something like this: "I'd like to talk with you about an important issue, but I'm concerned that you might get upset with me for bringing it up." Usually, curiosity will get the better of him, and he will assure you that he won't get angry. Believe it or not, this assurance will likely hold true, because his ego won't want him to feel foolish by going back on his word. According to research, people who are in a good mood are more likely to purchase a lottery ticket. When we are joyful, we tend to be more optimistic and are open to possibilities. Try not to allow your desire to speak your mind derail your ability to successfully plan your approach. Wait until you're both in a positive mood, so you both have the capacity to give. When we're in a bad mood or constricted state, we are only capable of taking, making it difficult to see the situation from the other person's perspective. When either one or both of you are hungry, tired, or plainly angry, do not expect that you will have a productive conversation. It's not going to happen too often, if ever. 10 steps to ego-free communication. 1. They don't care what you know till they know that you care. Without making a big deal about it, let the other person know you're saying this because you care. You care about him and your relationship. There is an age-old maxim: words that come from the heart enter the heart. Indeed, only a sincere and heartfelt expression of feelings, and more so criticism, has a chance of being effective. If you communicate your genuine concern for and interest in this person and your relationship with him, he'll receive your words the way you intended. 2. Privacy, please. Always express yourself in private. Even if you feel that he wouldn't mind others hearing your comments, do it behind closed doors. 3. Always begin with praise. First, emphasize the person's many good qualities and remarkable potential to pave the way for him to hear your point with equanimity. When this person knows that you have genuine respect and appreciation for him, perhaps even reverence or awe, then he'll hear your comments in a way that doesn't engage his ego. For instance, "You're one of the most productive employees, and I'm continually in awe of how you do what you do. I was just wondering about..." 4. Depersonalize the impact. Comments and critiques should address the act, not the person. In other words, instead of saying you're incompetent or reckless, it's better to say, "You're such a wonderful person, and this behavior doesn't seem suited to someone of your principled character." 5. Accidents happen. Don't assume or insinuate that this behavior is something that he's doing knowingly, consciously, or deliberately. If the situation allows, approach it as something he's doing unwittingly or even unconsciously. 6. We're in this together. Share some of the responsibility if you can. The approach of shared responsibility makes it you and him against this thing, not you against him. You might say something like, "I should have been more specific when we covered this." This approach is, of course, more effective than, "I hate it when you..." Or try, "I'm having a hard time when you..." rather than, "You have no right to," or "because you don't care enough." 7. Identify the problem and put energy into the solution. Expressing ourselves can be both empowering and cathartic, even when the other person is unable to fully understand what we're saying or how we're feeling. But if we are speaking out only to correct this person's behavior, then we want to be solution-oriented. If there is no answer, then you should never have brought it up in the first place, because it serves no purpose. And if you believe that no matter what you say, he won't take your advice, then it's also best not to bring it up. If you do, then you only serve your own interests, and you won't help the situation. 8. You're not alone. Criticism is most effective when you tell him that he's not alone. If you convey that whatever he has done or is doing is very common, and perhaps even something that you've done yourself, this diffuses the impact on his ego so that he won't take it so personally. And that's really the reason he might become so offended. When we openly acknowledge our own faults to the person we criticize, our humility then keeps the other's ego from engaging. Conversely, an attitude of self-righteousness will automatically galvanize the other's ego, and he will likely become defensive. 9. Speak softly and forget the stick. Be calm and pleasant. King Solomon stated, "The words of the wise, when spoken gently, are accepted." When these conversations take a turn for the worse, it's got less to do with who's right and who's wrong, and more with the wrong tone of voice. Speaking softly and politely will help the person digest your message in the manner you intend. Relationship expert Dr. John Gottman reports, 96% of the time you can predict the outcome of a conversation based on the first 3 minutes of the 15-minute interaction. A harsh startup dooms you to failure. The rule is, if it starts negative, it stays negative. 10. Far and away, then bombs away. The best time to criticize is when you are distanced from the event in proximity and in time. Being removed from the environment and putting time between the event and your criticism produce quite different results from speaking up immediately. Although you may verbally assure the person that the criticism is no big deal, you don't convey that attitude by offering your observation in the moment. By waiting a few days, you reduce his ego attachment to the situation, and he feels less sensitive to criticism. But the closer to the event, in both time and proximity, that you criticize, the more he identifies with his behavior, and the more defensive he will become. Expressing our displeasure is, at times, required and beneficial for our emotional and physical health. Yet articulating our feelings isn't the same as unleashing a torrent of unrestrained anger. When an objective assessment dictates that we should speak up, both our emotional health and the relationship can be enhanced. Yet without substance and sincerity, much less calm and composure, our words won't be productive to either the relationship or ourselves. Difficult people are not in our lives to add to our woes, but to help us. And we need to realize this, or they will keep coming around again and again. And so we might keep coming around again and again. On a simple level, it's true that we should help others, but we must also understand the larger picture and ask ourselves the important question, what lesson can I learn from this person? While we remain in blame mode, we are not solution-oriented and therefore can't see, let alone investigate, ways to improve the situation. Note: do you still have trouble seeing yourself as a healthy, assertive type? Chapter 24 shows you how to literally rewire your brain, not only to control your anger, but also to turn positive assertiveness into your second nature. 22. Successful relationships with impossible people. Because our emotional health and the quality of our relationships are intertwined, it's beneficial to do what we can to improve our relationships, even with people who are burdensome. As we learned, this doesn't mean that you have to include every difficult person in every aspect of your life, but to remove your ego from the equation when dealing with such a person. The following principles describe how to change the foundation of a relationship and enhance the way you interact and communicate with another person, whether you are seeking to improve a relationship with a friend, family member, or coworker. 1. RESPECT. Aretha Franklin sang the truth. Many personality conflicts arise as a result of someone feeling disrespected. You may have unintentionally not given someone your full attention, or they misinterpreted something you said or did. Although it doesn't take much for a person with low self-esteem to imagine that a person doesn't like them, this is true for all of us to some degree. There are aspects of ourselves that we dislike, and we project our own disdain with these qualities onto others. We believe, albeit unconsciously, that others must see these faults and dislike us as well. An effective way to show someone that you hold them in esteem is to tell a third party, maybe a mutual friend, what it is that you genuinely like and respect about this other person. Or you could commend this other person directly for something they have done, or for something they stand for. Once the person sees your admiration, the barriers of hostility will begin to break down. After all, it is hard to dislike someone who not only likes us, but also respects us. Have you ever had the experience of having someone whom you don't particularly like pay you a huge compliment or ask your advice about something? Suddenly, you find yourself forced to reevaluate your feelings toward them to something more favorable. We would rather adjust our thinking about someone than believe that their high opinion of us is flawed. This form of appreciation is known as reciprocal affection. We tend to like someone once we are told that they have the same feelings for us. To further this, avoid gestures or comments that indicate a lack of respect. Specifically, when someone is speaking to you, give them your undivided attention. Being half listened to, or more accurately, being half ignored, does not cultivate warm feelings. Perhaps you've had the experience of conversing with someone at an event when you suddenly become aware that their eyes are roving the room behind you, even as they're listening to you. Listening, really listening, is about respect. It might seem trivial, but this type of consideration for another person's honor significantly impacts a relationship. Imagine having a conversation with someone and their phone rings, but they choose not to answer it. And when you say, "Do you need to get that?" they simply say, "Don't worry about it. I'm only interested in talking to you right now." Wouldn't this make you feel good? 2. Let them give to you. We tend to believe that the way to get people to like us is to do nice things for them. Although this is true, people actually like us even more when they do something for us. This is due to the following two reasons. 1. Whenever we invest time, money, attention into anything, particularly a person, we care more about and feel more connected to the recipient of our giving. 2. When we allow others to give, they feel better about themselves, because giving reinforces the feeling that they are in control and independent. There is no greater way to bond with someone than by allowing them to be a part of your life and give to you. Ask a person for advice and input whenever you think they might have something worthwhile to contribute. 3. Show your human side. You should never be afraid of responsibly opening up to the people in your life. When you show your vulnerability, a wall between yourself and the other person dissolves, and empathy emerges. That person is then driven to respond to your needs as if they were his own. Often, in an attempt to get someone to like us, we employ what is called self-enhancement behavior. This is when we tell and show the other person how accomplished and wonderful we are, so that they will like us. Yet research clearly indicates that when you're dealing with a person who is insecure and feels threatened, self-deprecating behavior is the optimum approach. This would mean that you offer information about yourself that isn't flattering, but this admission shows humility, honesty, and trust, three traits that help provide a successful resolution to any personality conflict. 4. Recognize that like attracts like. Contrary to popular opinion, research in human behavior confirms that opposites do not attract. We may find some people interesting because of how different they are from us, but we actually connect more with people who are similar to us and have similar interests. Analogous to this law is the principle of comrades in arms. People who go through life-changing situations together tend to create a significant bond. For instance, soldiers in battle or those in fraternity pledge classes who get hazed together usually develop strong friendships. It's for this reason that two people who have never met but who have shared a similar previous experience, whether it's an illness or winning the lottery, can become instant friends. When you speak to this person, talk about what you both enjoy and what you have in common. 5. Show genuine enthusiasm. Psychologist Daniel Goleman writes, "It happens that smiles are the most contagious emotional signal of all, having an almost irresistible power to make other people smile in return." Smiling at someone not only helps them feel good about themselves, but also makes you feel good about yourself. The importance of immediately setting the right tone at the beginning of a conversation cannot be overstated. In every type of relationship, whether you are returning home to your spouse or greeting a coworker, those initial few moments together will dramatically shape the quality of the rest of your encounter. 6. Say a few kind words. It's unfortunate, but it seems that in many of our relationships, the only time we say something nice is when we've done something wrong. Be proactive from time to time. One kind word in the bank is worth 100 after the fact. In research examining 69 studies about influencing impressions and getting a person to like us, the most successful tactic was found to be simply making the other person feel good about themselves, whether through a sincere compliment or praise. The bottom line is that people crave feeling good about themselves, and most people are forced to rely on others to sustain them. One terrific and simple way to implement this with those closest to us is to express once or twice a day, via text, email, call, a short note, or in person, your admiration, respect, or appreciation for something specific. 7. Be an ally. If you learn that someone has made a mistake, reassure them that it could happen to anyone, and tell them they shouldn't be so hard on themselves. Whatever you do, don't criticize or condemn. In a situation where someone is having a disagreement, defend them when you believe there's merit to their side of the argument. And when the two of you have a disagreement, you don't win anything by proving that you're smarter than they are, whereas if you acknowledge that they've made an insightful point and validate their feelings, you have everything to gain, even if you disagree with them. 8. Either side of the aisle. Sometimes the source of conflict is rooted in something deeper, ideals. Objecting to a person's ideology does not usually give you the permission to sever the relationship or to hate the other person. However, the reason the relationship suffers is the way the two parties treat each other as a result of this divide. Invariably, with each disrespectful comment or disapproving glare, each side feels even more justified in disliking the other. It is this cycle of disrespect that gives way to ingrained hostility. The root of the conflict could be tolerable, even manageable, but because of the charged atmosphere, the two parties often allow their relationship to deteriorate to the point of no return. Even if a great deal of time has gone by, you can still reverse the situation by showing complete respect despite the other's comments and attitude. This method engages two psychological principles. The first psychological phenomenon is the previously discussed cognitive dissonance. If you're treating a person well in spite of how badly they're treating you, then they have to reconcile why they're being rude and intolerant to somebody who is kind and respectful. To resolve the contradiction, they will often be forced to conclude that you must be a good person who holds a flawed belief, rather than a bad person who should be ignored. The second psychological phenomenon is guilt reduction. Studies show that a person will do almost anything to eliminate feelings of guilt. When you're treating another person kindly, but they're treating you poorly, they will, on some level, feel guilty. In order to reconcile these feelings, they will be inclined to change their behavior and become more tolerant. Many people have friendships and relationships with people whose beliefs are fundamentally different from their own. The secret is to stay away from contentious subjects. Not every issue needs a thorough, complete, and intensive investigation. If you want to find something else to argue about, you will have no shortage of topics. Part 7. Advanced Psychological Strategies to Live Anger-Free. 23. The Power of Neuroplasticity. In the middle of a taxing circumstance, we might find it difficult to present a composed demeanor, let alone to feel calm. But little by little, our capacity to do so develops. By choosing a different response to anger now, we can better control ourselves the next time we feel provoked. For many years, conventional thinking likened the mind to a steam kettle in which pressure would build until the lid blew off. Psychologists thus encouraged people to release the buildup of pressure by venting their anger. Yet, after extensive research on the subject, it turns out that expressing anger is not only unproductive, but also destructive. When people vent their feelings aggressively, they often feel worse, pump up their blood pressure, and make themselves even angrier. Multiple experiments confirm that fits of rage are more likely to intensify anger. This happens because we unconsciously validate our reaction by convincing ourselves that the situation requires our emotionally charged response. In turn, our anger flares, and our self-justification increases our aggression. When we hold on to anger, we suffer, and the more we unleash it, the more it consumes us. The name given to this phenomenon, facial feedback hypothesis, extends to all physical expressions and falls under the principle of embodied cognition, which posits that thought is not merely influenced by physiology, but actually originates from it. In a series of studies, researchers asked subjects to look at disgusting images while hiding their emotions or while holding pens in their mouths in such a way to prevent them from frowning. A third group was given no instructions and told to react naturally. As expected, the subjects who restrained their emotional expression reported feeling less disgusted afterward than control subjects did. Our minds, seeking to reconcile our behavior with our emotional state, conclude that how we express ourselves must be a result of how we feel about the situation, or about whatever behavior we're engaging in. The tenet that our external actions mold our emotional world is at the root of the psychological principle that the outward act awakens the internal, and minds are shaped by deeds. Aristotle is quoted as saying, "We acquire virtues by first having put them into action." Today, behavior therapy, also referred to as behavior modification therapy, is built on just such an approach. This type of therapy focuses on changing undesirable behaviors by identifying and substituting them with more positive and healthier behaviors. Not only is the symptom being treated, but the behavior modification can also alter the person's personality from the outside in. Mind your brain. We are born with only two primal fears, the fear of falling and the fear of a loud, startling noise. Every other fear is learned, Our emotional response to any situation can be rerouted, for better or for worse. We find an apt illustration in PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, a severe anxiety disorder that can develop after a psychological trauma. A person who returns from war, for example, can suffer from such acute PTSD that the sound of a helicopter or a slamming door may cause sudden panic, because the brain has literally rewired itself based on a false conclusion. In such instances, adrenaline hijacks the brain and redirects the perceived threat from the prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, to the amygdala, the fear and anxiety response center. This fear-based disorder bears a striking similarity to an instinctive angry reaction. In the latter, our ego identifies a threat to our emotional selves rather than to our physical selves, and we don't think, we just react. Recent discoveries in molecular biology provide us with an understanding of the connection between behavior and circuits of the brain. While the mind creates emotional reactions, these are reinforced in the brain. For instance, if we become upset at someone who treats us impolitely, we will likely react more strongly the next time we encounter a similar situation, because the neural connection between rude people and our anger has been strengthened. Whatever we repeat strengthens the neuronal connections, whether practicing a musical instrument, becoming angry, or remaining calm. Every brain cell, neuron, adapts to its surroundings, or more precisely, to the signals the neuron receives from neighboring cells. When two neurons fire repeatedly at the same time, this reinforces the connection between them. Hence, the common idiom in biology, neurons that fire together wire together. In fact, this proves true for both emotional and physical responses to stimuli, as a study in Psychology Today explains. Just like muscles, brain circuits grow stronger when we use them. Great when you're learning to play the piano, but terrible in the case of a constantly aching joint. Pain pathways are like a trail in the forest, says Gavril Pasternak, director of molecular neuropharmacology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. If you have a path that is already worn, it is easier to follow and it becomes strengthened. Through the same neurological process that makes you gradually get better at hitting a racquetball or driving a stick shift, your brain gets better at perceiving the pain. You become more sensitive and more likely to register a poke or a twinge as painful. Eventually, people with chronic pain disorders such as fibromyalgia, which affects joints and soft tissues, can find even mild sensations agonizing. Imaging studies reveal what's going on. A gentle touch causes brain areas that process pain to react. Similar findings have been reported in people with unexplained chronic lower back pain. It's not a conscious process. It's one way the brain naturally responds to repeated stimulation. Returning to our immediate discussion, learning a new response, such as remaining calm when in the face of insult or when we feel otherwise disrespected, anxious, or out of control, stimulates the associated neurons to grow extensions, dendrites, to connect with one another. Dendrites, the branched projections of a neuron, deliver information to and from the cell. The greater the number of dendrites, the faster and more smoothly we can understand related information and integrate what we learn into our knowledge base. We literally become smarter, more efficient, and more effective in this area. The inverse equally applies. Underused connections gradually deteriorate and eventually fade. Using an electron microscope, we can even see how the inactive connections in the brain gradually disappear. A person can thereby fuel the self-control coffers by maintaining control, or unwittingly deplete his capacity to restrain himself with willful, repeated, prolonged outbursts of rage. How long does it take? Neural pathways are in constant motion. When a blind person compensates for his lack of sight by developing his sense of touch to learn Braille, the borders of the brain begin to realign in just minutes, expanding areas of the cerebral cortex that control the index finger. How long it takes to fully impress a new neural network depends on the intensity, duration, and frequency of both the established routine and the new replacement behavior. Conflicting conclusions exist, in part because we must consider a multitude of factors. Traditionally accepted findings state that constant repetitive action reconfigures our brains once the neural pathways are bombarded for 21 consecutive days. More recent research from the European Journal of Social Psychology finds that it takes, on average, 66 days of continuous activity to ingrain a new habit into our physiology. Then, with sufficient repetition, the new behavior becomes automatic. Still, other research suggests that the brain requires focused repetition for 6 months for neuroplasticity to effect complete change, so that we instinctively respond differently. However long it takes, this doesn't mean that we won't experience slip-ups after this point. Yet it does mean that we will have a physiological advantage in every situation right from the start. Anger begets anger, and silence begets calm. King Solomon said, "A gentle response turns away anger. A harsh response increases anger." Most people traditionally interpreted this as referring to the person we speak to, but the anger he refers to is also our own. We can retrain our brains by establishing a different meaning for the situation, an intellectual or cognitive approach, in which we ask ourselves, "What does this mean?" and come to the non-ego-oriented reality that we have spoken about in the first several sections. This then resets our emotional response. Another way we can retrain our brains is by forcing ourselves to go beyond aiming for a neutral, calm demeanor and display the opposite behavior. If you recall the previously mentioned phenomena of facial feedback hypothesis, the very act of smiling sends the brain a message that the situation is non-threatening, not only that it's safe to relax, but also that we're already relaxed. In Chapter 27, we will examine a highly effective application for this, to calm ourselves in the heat of the moment. 24. Change your self-concept, change your life. Self-esteem reflects how we feel about ourselves, while the self-concept refers to what we know about ourselves. Up until now, we've focused on increasing self-esteem, but now we'll introduce a way for us to positively reshape the self-concept, and rather than change the lens through which we view ourselves, we'll change who we look at. Researchers posed as safety inspectors and asked homeowners whether they would allow the inspectors to place a large "Drive Carefully" sign in their front yards. Only 17% gave permission. Other residents, however, were first approached with a smaller request. The safety inspectors asked them to hang a 3-inch "Be a Safe Driver" sign in a window. Nearly all homeowners immediately agreed. A few weeks later, the inspectors asked these homeowners to place the gigantic sign on their front lawns. This same group overwhelmingly agreed. 76% consented to having the unsightly sign in their front yards. Why the radical discrepancy between the two groups? It's simple. Those who first agreed to the smaller request had reshaped their self-concept and now defined themselves as being serious about driver safety. Therefore, by agreeing to the larger request, they signified their ongoing internal commitment to the cause. Human beings feel driven to act in accordance with how they see themselves. Like a rubber band, we will stretch only so far before snapping back into our original position. Yet revising our self-concept doesn't happen only through our actions, but via the faculty of imagination. Visualization has an amazing ability to transform us because the subconscious mind can't distinguish between imagination and an actual happening. In fact, neuroscientists have identified which parts of the brain light up when a person has a genuine experience and found that the same regions activate when the person simply imagines the experience. Visualization is so potent that experiments show it producing changes in the body as well as in the mind. For instance, our muscles gain similar strength whether we actually do an exercise or merely visualize ourselves doing it. One study found that if participants imagine doing finger exercises, their strength increased by an average of 22%. By comparison, another test group that actually physically did the same regimen increased their strength by an average of 30%. Repetitive action patterns also have long-term neural consequences. Scientists have observed these effects at the cellular and the systemic level, even extending to the motor cortex, the muscles that people imagined exercising, along with related muscles. 60 studies on the power of mental imagery show that the effect was least significant on strict strength tests, better for motor tasks, and best of all for performance with a mental component, most notably, to exercise control over our anger. We don't need to wait for a challenging situation to occur and then rely on sheer will to overcome our emotional reaction. If we imagine ourselves responding in a certain way, it reshapes our self-concept and produces the same changes in the brain that the actual behavior does. Mentally rehearsing a calm, patient response, for instance, will help our brain reset itself and can accelerate our ability to maintain self-control even under the most daunting of circumstances. We can also benefit by reflecting on actual or imagined instances when we displayed a particular trait. A mental peculiarity called availability heuristics shows that people often base their self-concept on availability, or how easily they can bring information to mind. For instance, if we could think of several times when we acted calmly and could recall these events quickly, then we would see ourselves, at that moment, as someone with self-control. However, if we had difficulty recalling ever being in a calm state, we would feel that we characteristically react anxiously or angrily. For this reason, some people have a warped perspective of themselves. They have a computer-like memory for remembering their failures and mistakes in life, so they see themselves as failures. Even if our triumphs far outweigh our mistakes, what we readily remember will dictate how we see ourselves. We can accomplish something else by using this technique. We can become more at ease in asserting ourselves. By rehearsing those times when we stood up for ourselves and expressed our thoughts in a calm and clear way, our memory will be flush with these scenarios, and our self-concept will shape itself around this persona and prime us to behave in this way. Simply recall 5 to 7 times that you asserted yourself and string them together to create a vivid 60-second movie trailer that you can play in your head several times throughout the day and at those times when you need a turbo boost of assertiveness. The cost and the consequences. The most valuable way to use visualization is not simply to uproot individual traits, but to acquire the habit of stopping, thinking, and feeling the consequences of our conduct, to fully absorb where our choices will lead us. If we want to control our anger, we want to get real. We must recognize what's at stake and permit ourselves to feel the unadulterated pain of the wrong choice, as well as the purity and pleasure of choosing responsibly. As we move beyond rational arguments about long-term costs and benefits, it's essential that we immerse ourselves in the travesty of the trade-off and the actual harm to us and to our loved ones. We need to vividly imagine the painful consequences and become realistic about what our behavior has cost us thus far. We must visualize what our lives will look like in 5 years, in 10 years, or in old age if we don't change our ways. We should also reflect deeply on how we will feel about ourselves and how different our lives can be if we become anger-free. The research is definitive. In his book, We Have Met the Enemy, Self-Control in an Age of Excess, Daniel Axt writes, "What matters when it comes to self-control is not so much willpower as vision, the ability to see the future so that the long-run consequences of our short-run choices are vividly clear. In that sense, our shortcomings in this arena are really failures of imagination. Drenching ourselves with total awareness of the consequences is a powerful remedy for impulsiveness. Yet consequences matter to us only if we matter to ourselves. Strategies can help us exercise self-restraint, but the only way to rouse our emotional forces is to remind ourselves that we have a higher, more noble purpose. Reaffirming our core values, knowing what we are living for and who we are, a soul, not a body or an ego, is the strongest factor in replenishing strength of will. 25. Taking advantage of the mind-body connection. Anger inhibits our ability to see clearly because the ego distorts our perspective and our ability to intellectually process information due to the impact of elevated cortisol levels. Moreover, coping with any kind of stress depletes our willpower, and a chaotic mind and tense nervous system strain our efforts to maintain our calm, regardless of our finest intentions. Common sense testifies to the conclusion of innumerable studies. The calmer we are in ordinary times, the easier it is for us to control our anger in difficult times. The following physiological factors are highly beneficial in reducing our overall stress and anxiety level. Meditation. One effective way to relax the nervous system is through meditation, which, interestingly, has deep roots in almost every major religion or spiritual practice. While a variety of effective stress management strategies can help us exercise self-control, meditation has proved to be especially useful, and you can enjoy the dividends remarkably fast. Studies show that people who meditated for about 30 minutes a day for 8 straight weeks had noticeable increases in gray matter density in the prefrontal cortex. At the same time, MRI brain scans showed a reduction of gray matter in the amygdala, a region responsible for anxiety and stress. More than 1,000 independent scientific studies conducted at 200 universities and institutions in 27 countries, published in leading scientific journals, attest to the psychological and physiological benefits of meditative practice. Herbert Benson, M.D., a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School who has authored or co-authored more than 170 papers, reports that frequent meditation reduces the level of anxiety, worry, and unconstructive thoughts and fears, as well as increasing the individual level of happiness. He writes, "Meditation induces a host of biochemical and physical changes in the body, collectively referred to as the relaxation response. The relaxation response includes changes in metabolism, heart rate, respiration, blood pressure, and brain chemistry." Other findings show that meditation promotes overall psychological health, with benefits that include enhanced confidence and greater self-control, empathy, and self-actualization, as well as decreased anger in high-intensity situations. Breathing meditation in 5 quick and easy steps. Breathing is most effective because it is among the few biological processes that are involuntary and unconscious, and yet we can easily alter it through conscious thought, thus creating a bridge between the unconscious and the conscious minds. In time, this helps us gain control over untamed and unwelcomed thoughts and feelings. Here are the basic steps. Step 1. Make the atmosphere conducive. You can step out and feel the warmth of sunlight or go for a darkened room. Look for a quiet and serene place that is completely free of distractions or just from extraneous noise. This could be an extra room in your house, the woods, or anywhere that is tranquil. Step 2. Take a comfortable position. The traditional cross-legged lotus position is fine but unnecessary. The objective is to be comfortable and to assume a position that will not make your body ache or cause distractions during your breath meditation. The simplest position is to sit in a comfortable chair with your feet flat on the floor, hands resting on your lap or armrests. Step 3. Start by slowly breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. Each breath in should be held for about 4 to 6 seconds and then slowly released. Be mindful of your breath, how it feels as you inhale, then as you hold it, and then as you slowly exhale. After 5 minutes or so, move on to the next step. Step 4. Now breathe effortlessly, without any interest in managing the pace or rhythm. Your attention is still on your breath, but do not be concerned with how and when to breathe in or out. Just breathe comfortably, naturally. It is inevitable that your mind will wander and thoughts will enter, and that's okay. Whenever you become aware that your attention has drifted, gently turn your focus back onto your breath. Step 5. After 15 or 20 minutes, or even after just a few minutes if you are pressed for time, end your breath meditation session by slowly opening your eyes and taking a moment or two to acclimate to your surroundings. Adrenaline and exercise. Caffeine activates the body's fight or flight response, triggering the release of adrenaline and cortisol just as it would for any stressful situation. Indirectly, yet equally injurious, is the role of glucose. When we eat foods high in sugar or refined carbohydrates, blood sugar spikes and then sharply declines, which then stimulates the adrenals to regulate blood sugar levels. While the cumulative effect can wreak havoc on the nervous system, the immediate impact is staggering. A Yale University study found that a single serving of a sugar-sweetened beverage caused adrenaline levels to double in adults and quadruple in children. Recent studies also show that those who suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, panic attacks, and anxiety may find relief with a diet low in refined sugars and simple carbohydrates. Our diet is important for another unrelated reason. Anger-prone moments require the mental muscle of self-control or willpower, which, much like physical muscle, utilizes glucose. Findings show that we are most susceptible to losing our temper when glucose levels are low or not metabolized properly. A diet rich in complex carbohydrates, healthy fats, and proteins helps to reduce the fluctuation of glucose levels and thus tilts physiology in our favor. The stress-reducing effects of physical activity are well documented in cross-sectional studies. Regarding anger specifically, Dr. Nathaniel Tome, a leading stress physiologist, finds that exercise, even a single bout of it, can have a robust prophylactic effect against the buildup of anger. Prudence, however, is advised, as a worldwide study published in the American Heart Association's journal Circulation cautions that a person should not exercise while they are angry because it can triple the risk of a heart attack within the first hour. Deep breathing and progressive muscle relaxation. And we're back to breath. As we noted, anger is directly associated with the fight-or-flight response, and deep breathing and muscle relaxation exercises outside of a high-arousal situation are effective at reducing our anger within the situation. Notice how high-strung, nervous people carry themselves. Their bodies are often tense and stiff. The central nervous system is made up of our brain and spinal cord, and it is difficult to completely relax the mind unless we relax our physical selves as well. A daily 5-minute breathing and muscle relaxation routine will be beneficial to raising your overall anger threshold. Let's take a quick look. Deep breathing. This highly effective technique can quickly relieve tension, increase oxygenation, and release toxins. Step 1. Find a quiet spot where you can either sit comfortably or lie down. Breathe normally, focusing on your breath. Step 2. After a minute or so, inhale deeply through your nose, filling your lungs with air. Step 3. Once your lungs are full, slowly exhale through your mouth with your attention on your breath. Continue to breathe in for about 6 seconds through your nose, hold for 4 to 6 seconds, and breathe out for about 6 seconds through your mouth, slowly. Repeat for several minutes. Most of our breathing is shallow and constricted, so if you are not familiar with deep breathing, you may find it easier to practice lying down and to place your hand on your stomach. As you slowly inhale, expand your chest and abdomen and feel your hand rise and then fall with each exhale. Progressive muscle relaxation. This exercise offers relief for a wide range of emotional and physiological ailments, as well as for overall stress reduction. Through practice, we can better recognize when we are experiencing physical tension and learn to quickly relax those muscles to ease the accompanying stress and anxiety. We start by slowly tensing and then relaxing each muscle group and progressively working our way up the body. Here are the areas to focus on. A. Each foot. B. Each thigh. C. Buttocks. D. Stomach. E. Each hand. F. Each arm and bicep. G. Neck and shoulders. H. Jaw. And I. Eyes and forehead. Find a quiet place to lie down and loosen any clothing that might prevent you from relaxing properly. Next, close your eyes and take a few deep breaths and begin to feel the tension flow out. Relax your jaw, your eyes, your forehead, and slowly scan your body, relaxing those areas that are tense and tight, and let yourself sink down. The entire first step should take no more than 2 minutes. Now, focus on your right foot. Slowly move it around and notice how that feels. Tense your foot muscles gradually until you feel as though they are as tense as possible without causing yourself pain. Count for about 5 seconds and then release the tension slowly. Notice how limp your foot feels. Relax for 30 seconds, breathing deeply and slowly. Then place your attention on your left foot. Follow the same pattern of gently moving, tensing, and then releasing. Make sure to take 30 seconds or so to relax with some deep breaths before moving on to your calf and in between each body part, and then progress gradually up through your body, contracting and relaxing the muscle groups along the way. Wholesale visualization. When you have the time, fold in this quick visualization exercise. Close your eyes for a moment and get comfortable. Now, imagine moving through your day anger-free and the impact that has on various aspects of your life and relationships. What do you look like? How do you feel about things? What are you saying to yourself? What is your environment like? Has it changed? Who are the people you are surrounded with? How are they looking at you? What are they saying to you? How do you react and interact with them? Now take a moment and step back into your own body, feeling both calm and energized about who you can become.